Hi everyone, this is John Hamel of the Association of Domestic Violence Intervention Programs. Today's podcast will feature Jennifer Jill Harmon, a PhD who received her doctorate in social psychology from the University of Connecticut and who specializes in the study of intimate relationships. She's currently an associate professor of psychology at Colorado State University. Dr. Harmon is an accomplished and awarded teacher and has published many peer-reviewed articles and book chapters and has presented her research regularly at scientific conferences around the world. She's the co-author of several books, including The Science of Relationships, Answers to Your Questions About Dating, Marriage, and Family and Parents Acting Badly, How Institutions and Society Promote the Alienation of Children from Their Loving Families. Dr. Harmon's areas of research focus on the topic of power in relationships, power in how intimate partners influence each other for good and bad. And for the last decade or so, her primary focus has been on the study of parental alienation. And that's what we're going to focus on today. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Harmon, and let's get started. You ready?
Yes, thanks for having me.
Very good. The reason I contacted you is because I came across one of your recent articles in a peer-reviewed journal. I was very impressed for many reasons, your grasp of the material, the topic, and then the way you specify the different types of parental alienation. So I want to start with the first question is, what exactly is parental alienation? And can you give us some specific examples of that?
Yeah, so parental alienation refers to the outcomes that we see in a child that are where they're rejecting a parent who is normally a healthy parent, but they're rejecting them for very illogical or untrue reasons. And we see it manifested in a lot of ways. There's several symptoms that are typical for children who are alienated. And these symptoms are unique for alienated children, meaning that we don't see them among children who are abused for other reasons. Okay. So some of those symptoms would be things like lack of ambivalence. So the child will feel very strong hatred and anger towards a parent, and they don't feel any guilt towards that, about feeling those things. We see splitting behaviors. So the child will idealize one parent. That parent, put them on a pedestal, while the other parent is trash to them, or that they're horrible and mean or bad. And so you see the splitting that happens with these children. We also see like what we call a spreading of animosity, meaning that not only does the hatred for that parent that they're rejecting show itself, but you also see it spreading to anybody associated with that parent, including extended family members and even pets. And there's several other symptoms, but those are some of the key ones that are really identifiable when we're looking at children who are alienated.
And what are some examples of the kinds of behaviors that parents engage in that causes children to be alienated from another parent?
Oh, there's so many of them, and it's very sad. I regularly review case studies for court for parents sometimes when they're trying to make sense about what's going on, and the list is endless. But there are some categories that have been identified first by Amy Baker and Doug Darnell in a classic paper published several years ago. And I find similar kind of categories in my own research. And so what you see typically are some bad-mouthing behaviors, so derogation of the parent to the child, telling the child that the person's bad, they don't love them, that they are, evil, that they're abusive. They might derogate the other parent in front of the child as well. So if they see him at a parenting time exchange, they would yell and tell them how horrible they are in front of the child. We'll see them derogate that parent to others. So they'll, badmouth them to teachers, doctors, anybody who will hear them. So those are one cluster of behaviors. We also see interfering with contact and information. So be a lot of gatekeeping behaviors. We see this primarily with parents who have custodial status, where they will kind of prevent any contact with the child when they're in their care. They will do things to try to minimize visitation with the other parent. you know, require supervised visits when there's actually been no abuse in the relationship, do lots of things to try to prevent relationships or any connection with them. We also see interfering of time when they're with the other parent. So when they're with the rejected parent and the parent's trying to have some quality time with them, the alienating parent will often interfere with that by texting them nonstop, calling, you know, even harassing and stalking them. And we also see then also a lot of loyalty-inducing behaviors. So sometimes the alienating parent doesn't even do any of those other things, but they do lots of things to increase the alliance of the child, to favor them and reject the other parent. So they'll do things like, you know, cry when they drop the kids off for their parenting time with the other parent and say how much they're going to miss them and they don't know what they're going to do when they're away from them. And making the child feel really bad and guilty about leaving that parent. And those kinds of behaviors, you know, are very manipulative and very insidious because you can't always see them. You know, they're very indirect and they often happen behind closed doors. And the behaviors don't even end there. There's lots of other behaviors, you know, like adultification of the children, you know, making them feel like they have more power in the family than they actually should. Letting the children make the choice about whether they want to see the other parent or not, which is not an appropriate choice to ever put on a child. We see a lot of antisocial behaviors, stalking behaviors of alienators towards the targeted parent. We see economic abuse, same kinds of behaviors you would see with other kinds of family violence or domestic violence. And in fact, I just published a, or we're just publishing a book chapter, my colleague Mandy Mathewson and I, where we take the power and control wheel that's often used with the Duluth model,
Right.
and we actually just added in, or we transport, like we kind of just transformed it and adapted it to the parental alienation kind of context. Because actually, those behaviors map on exactly to what these alienating parents do. So that chapter should be coming out in the next few months. So, but anything you would kind of see in other kinds of domestic violence are things you typically see with alienation cases as well.
Right, and you've heard of Denise Hines. She's at Clark University.
Yes.
Denise has done a lot of work with, well, her work recently has been with abused men, and she points out that that lots of individuals in abusive relationships will use the court system just in general to manipulate the other partner. So it's not always, it doesn't always involve parental alienation. It might be threatening to call INS for. In relationships where one or more partners is in the United States without papers, it might be using the calling the police on a false domestic violence call, things of that nature. So, would you consider parental alienation to be one of those manipulative behaviors that call falls in line generally with these kind of behaviors where the court system is manipulated or outside institutions are manipulated?
Absolutely. In fact, and Denise calls those legal and administrative aggression.
Right.
And yeah, in the paper that we wrote for Psychological Bulletin, that we kind of outline that in one of our sections because that is a very common strategy. I mean, we know that when parents are separating or divorcing, they're, you see three times as many allegations of abuse than you do in other kinds of family dynamics. She's published a paper where showing that when parents, particularly fathers who are leaving relationships, are nearly half of them are threatened with allegations of abuse that you know that were false, and many of them were actually filed, and or I think there were about the recent paper that I saw of hers. I think it was about 20 to 30% actually filed false child abuse allegations when they left the relationship. And we see that from mothers too. It's not just fathers who deal with this, who are leaving relationships. I mean, that's a common strategy for any abusive parent to make these kinds of threats.
I believe that you, as I just recall that you, I think you wrote a paper with Denise Hines at some point.
So, yeah, so I published a paper with Denise Hines in December, in Psychological Bulletin. And in there, we definitely talk about legal administrative aggression that's used by parents who are alienating their children. And we do see that Rates of allegations or the prevalence of false allegations that are made are very common among families that are separating. In fact, three times as many families make these kinds of or parents make these kind of allegations when there's custody disputes. So it's a very common strategy, and they won't just use the courts. You know, they'll use police, they'll use child protective services. And we often see patterns of these. You know, some parents will make constant allegations whenever the relationship is ended in order to try to gain a custody advantage.
So, what would you say would be the percentage, in your best estimate, of child custody litigants who do engage in parental alienation? Would you say it's more than 10%?
Oh, that's a good question. And in fact, that's a question that I've been trying to answer in my research. Because it's tough to estimate because you have the difference between parental alienating behaviors, which a lot of parents do, and the alienation outcomes. And not all children actually become alienated. Fortunately, a lot of children have resilience. Some are more susceptible than others. You might have a parent engaging in very egregious behaviors, but the children somehow are able to, sometimes because they have custody, you know, shared custody, they're able to kind of buffer that. Or, you know, their lived experience with the targeted parent is actually positive to offset the negativity. So it's really hard to estimate that unless we can actually do clinical assessments of the children. Now, I do know in my research, I conducted a poll several years ago using a representative sample of adults from North Carolina. And since it's representative, I was able to make an estimate based on US Census data. And in that one, we estimated about 14.3% of parents feel like they're being alienated from their child by the other parent. Now, I just finished three national polls, two in the US and one in Canada. And I'm analyzing that data now, so I can't give it away yet, but the estimate is actually much higher of parents who feel like that's happening to them. And in those polls, I actually measured a lot of things. I didn't just ask them, do you feel like you're being alienated? I asked them, are these behaviors happening to you?
I work with court-mandated domestic violence offenders, many of whom are going through a custody dispute. Mostly work with men, although we have women's groups. But whether they're male or female, many of the ones who are referred to us through the family court system believe that their child's been alienated by the other parent. But I don't always find that to be the case. I'll follow up with some questions about, well, how is the child being alienated? And I'd say, a good percentage of the time, the child and the parent just don't have a good relationship, or the person in my program just is upset and resentful that they've been court ordered to do this. And I in some cases it seems like they're trying to even the score by accusing the other parent of being alienating. But much of the time it's true. There appears to be evidence of that this is so, but it's not always the case. Often it's just they're just saying that. So it's good that you're following up with questions that make the respondent kind of point out what it is that's going on to bring some evidence to bear.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the last poll that I conducted, I actually used a validated measure that was just published by Gina Rowland, where it was looking at the parent's assessment of their actual relationship with their child. You know, so is their child demonstrating symptoms of parental alienation? And there was about 36 questions or something. And so I can actually look at now finally and analyze and see what percentage of them who say that they're being alienated actually have children who meet the criteria, and it was normed on a sample of parents who have been alienated.
Jennifer, before we move on, let me just ask you to tell the listeners the name of this questionnaire, and can they get it now if they were to contact you?
Questionnaire, it was published by Gina Rowland just recently. It's called the Rowland Parental Alienation Scale. And I forgot what journal it's published in. Yeah, if you want to reach out to me, I have a, you know, I'm sure I can share the link to the journal where people can find that. I obviously, as an academic, I have access to that kind of, I don't have to pay, I don't hit a paywall when I want to get the articles, but if anybody runs into that and they need to reach me to see if I can get it for them, just feel free to reach out to me.
Okay.
Yes. So hopefully I will have a better answer for you, hopefully, to that question in a few years. I know that Bill Burnett, and Richard Warshak have tried to take various estimation procedures to try to see how many children really are affected by parental alienation. They both kind of fall to about 1% of children in the US. I would guess, I think it depends though on how severe you're talking, right? Because I think 1% might factor for these children who are pretty severe. But there are a lot of children that I think we have to be very careful because sometimes there's children who are stuck in what we call loyalty conflicts or loyalty binds. And that's a very different dynamic, you know. So that's where you have two parents acting kind of badly, and the power with them is actually pretty equal. You know, they both have maybe custody, but sometimes they co-parent okay, but they have some conflicts, and that's not alienation. You know, that's not what we would consider parental alienation at all. Parental alienation is usually where you see a very unequal power dynamic. You have one parent who is acting in a very abusive way towards the other one, and that then affects children quite differently than what you would see for children who are kind of in this triangulation or where they're stuck in the middle. That's a very different dynamic, what I study.
Well, does the parent who is doing the alienating, does that parent normally have the primary custody, or can alienation be done by the parent who is the parent on the out, so to speak, the one who's maybe just visiting the child?
It's more common among parents who have custody just because they're in a position where they have more time and control over the situation, but not always. I mean, I've in my research, and I know that of others, people have definitely come across parents who were able to alienate their children and they were not the primary custodial parent. So, for example, the children would go home and visit them for the summer if they lived in two different states, and then the children will call and say, "I'm never coming back." Or they'll keep visiting for, you know, this might happen like over a few weeks or a few months of visits with that parent on the weekends, and then the child just decides I don't want to see them again. So it can happen that way, but typically we see the parent who has more custody being the one who is perpetrating the abuse. And you know, and it makes sense because the children are living with them. They have control over the outcomes of the child. You know, they typically are, you know, can control all the resources for that child and their access to the other parent. And so it kind of puts them in a position where they have more power because of their custodial status, and it allows them the opportunity to abuse it if they should, you know, should choose to.
That makes sense. You and I know that there are a lot of stereotypes and assumptions out there. One of them is that domestic violence is perpetrated mostly by the dads, but alienation is perpetrated by moms. And I know that that's not, the life is a lot more complex than that in these families. So would you talk about what you see as any particular gender differences in terms of who alienates and who's doing that kind of behavior?
Yeah, that's a good question because I often hear people say, well, alienation is just something that abusive dads claim to get control of their children or custody of their children. And that's not true at all. You know, because you can make the same argument about moms who claim that they were abused, right? You could make the same argument. And so, or you could make the same kind of claim, but it's not true. The data does not support that. The data actually in my study, as well as the three polls, I can at least tell you this for a fact that the three polls I just ran, we do not find gender differences in the parents who feel they've been alienated. Other researchers have not found gender differences in parents who've been alienated. What we do find, though, is that there are gender differences in terms of who ultimately ends up in court. So, for example, Demosthenes Lourandos, is just publishing data right now on a large case review study that he's done in the US cases where alienation was at issue. And I believe he found that over 70% of the cases involved the father as the victim. And It makes sense. I mean, I think for a lot of reasons it makes sense, because primarily, a lot of mothers are granted custody more than fathers. And so it's not that the dads are more likely to be victimized than moms. I think there's sometimes then just a lot of biases that happen along the way that make it get worse, right? That require court intervention. And sometimes, obviously fathers may have more resources as well to fight it in court. And so I know a lot of the mothers that I've worked with, they often ha are very, they don't have anything. Well, a lot of the dads I work with do don't have anything either after fighting in court for so long. But I think that can also explain why we sometimes see gender differences in terms of who's presenting to court, right? And who's showing up and who's appealing their cases, because appealing a case is very expensive. So it makes sense then that we start to see some gender differences fall out there. But overall, moms and dads are just as affected. I mean, this is just like any violence. We see moms and dads are just as capable of this. And I have a paper that's actually under review right now where we're looking at what kinds of alienating behaviors moms and dads do, and are there gender differences in those? Because we do know that moms and dads general, or men and women generally use different strategies to aggress against other people. So we were interested to see if that was the case for these kinds of behaviors. And what we found in interview study that I conducted, as well as a legal case review study of cases that were in appellate cases in the US, we found that typically moms will use a lot more indirect behaviors than dads. Or not, sorry. I don't want to misquote this. Moms will use twice as many indirect behaviors as direct behaviors, meaning they will try to badmouth the parent to other people, use very indirect ways to attack them, like use le legal aggression, administrative aggression, turn other people against them. Whereas dads will use equal numbers of both, right? So dads will often use direct and indirect forms of aggression. And direct aggression would be things like, provoking somebody at a parenting time exchange, or having the child, telling the child to go and, hit the other parent and that kind of thing. Yes. And so we do find some gender differences with that. And so, I think because of that, then we sometimes see it's more noticeable if so, for example, if fathers are using both kinds of strategies equally, direct strategies are easier to see, right? And so, whereas if mothers are using more indirect strategies, it's harder to see. And if somebody's a custody evaluator or an expert who's trying to assess this, this makes identifying parental alienation quite challenging, because you need to find these kinds of behaviors that are happening behind the scenes, and it's not always easy to locate that kind of information unless you have access to lots and lots of sources of data.
In my experience, and I have never tried to quantify it, but just my subjective view is that alienating moms are more likely to use gatekeeping, because moms usually are the ones that handle the doctor's appointments and things of that nature. So a lot of dads will say to me that, she was supposed to tell me about this appointment, and then she claims that she got busy and didn't get a chance to tell me until after the appointment. And so it seems like a lot of these are, it's hard to prove the mom deliberately forgot to tell dad about the this medical appointment for their child, as opposed to recording of dad yelling at mom or telling mom that she's stupid while they're talking, while the child is listening. So you think that the fact that moms typically are the gatekeepers in the family may have something to do with the fact that they're more likely to engage in these more subtle types of or less visible alienating behaviors?
It could be, yeah. I mean, I've been kind of putting a lot of thought into this because I've been asked to review a lot of different cases for court for parents, and I've had to kind of be creative about how I try to identify what parents are doing. And it often requires me combing through lots of emails, lots of mediated communication, lots of text messages, and pulling out a calendar and seeing, like just what you said, like if there's a doctor appointment, why is this parent only being told about it the day before, right? Or they get the explanation of benefits statement that says the child was taken to the doctor, and then I look back and I don't see any communication about that appointment. Right. So it takes a lot of forensic detective work in a way to really identify it. And I know most parents can't afford somebody to go through their whole life like that because it's, you know, it's very time consuming. And that's my kind of best advice for a parent who's going through this. If they think it's happening, is try to do a lot of that legwork yourself, you know, really document not just saving your emails, but getting the timeline on which things happen really helps to, I think, identify when it's happening. At least for somebody like me who, you know, experts can usually, we have like what we call pattern recognition. You know, we start, when you see the same thing over and over again, I can quickly identify like, yeah, looks like that's happening because I've seen it time and again every day, you know, as I'm sure you do when you practice, you see the same kinds of behaviors or strategies over and over, and yeah, it becomes easy to identify when you know what you're looking for. But
do you do child custody evaluations?
I don't do child custody evaluations. I'm a researcher. I'm a faculty member, and I don't have time for that. And I'm not a clinician anymore. I used to do some clinical work, but I like doing research. I do sometimes. I have been appointed by a court to serve as an expert working with custody evaluators, because a lot of custody evaluators don't have the expertise to look for this kind of thing. They have a little bit of knowledge, but to the level in which I look at it, as a researcher, I look pretty deeply at almost every behavior and everything I can get my hands on, you know, and so I'll often be appointed by the court to work collaboratively with a custody evaluator. And sometimes, you know, we might submit completely different reports, you know, but I think any information a court will get is useful for their own, you know, decisions that they have to make. But I at least, you know, present as a researcher or as an expert on alienation, I at least say, here's what I think is happening. And I will work with a custody evaluator to get their perspective because they will have had the opportunity to observe children with the parent. And I will interview the parents, but the observations with the children is something that, you know, as a custody evaluator, that's what they would do. And oftentimes with alienation too, it's tough because children have been brainwashed or they've been gaslight, you know, the parents been engaging in so many gaslighting techniques with them. They don't have their own kind of, they haven't really formed their own opinion, right? They've come to a conclusion that's been completely fed by a parent. It's one-sided. They don't know all the details about what's been happening. And so it's hard for them to make their own decision. And so usually a lot of forensic interviewers that I know who work in this area say it's actually not entirely informative to talk to a child who's been alienated because it's all it's really going to do is confirm for you that they have been. it's not going to usually discount that alienation's a problem if you see all these other behaviors and manifestations of alienation in the child.
Earlier in our interview, you told us about the types of signs of alienation in children, the kinds of things that for example, you said that they're not very ambivalent at all. They have these very definite opinions. Aside from those signs of alienation, what is the short-term impact, let's say emotionally or in terms of school performance and other types of, any other problems that children have who are being alienated? Do they seem to suffer in different walks of life or emotionally? Talk about that. And then also, what are some of the long-term consequences, do you believe, that comes from a child being alienated?
Oh, well, that's a great question. And it's actually not much different than you see with any other kinds of abuse. Because either way, this is abuse. It's just how the abuse is happening that's different, right? And aside from the symptoms that make it different from other kinds of abuse, you see the other outcomes are very similar to children who are like sexually abused or emotionally abused, physically abused. You see a lot of anxiety, depression, you know, migraines, you know, psychosomatic symptoms. You can see drops in academic performance, but sometimes the children learn to compartmentalize very well. And on some levels, it looks like they're doing great, but emotionally, they're very stunted. They have to like essentially compartmentalize their lives in order to survive. You know, if they're able to kind of go back and forth, if they're able to maintain a relationship with the parent who they're rejecting, and they still are rejecting them, but they're only like moderately alienated, and they're dealing with the severe alienation from the parent. That child, in order to survive, I mean, they really have to live two different lives, and they cannot talk about that parent when they're with the other one. They can't acknowledge their existence, and they really have to shut off a part of themselves in order to survive in that kind of environment. And so you'll see this sort of emotional stunting. The child will be stuck, like when the abuse started, they'll be stuck developmentally at that age. And so on the surface, it may look like they're very mature. And in fact, you see this a lot with alienation cases where particularly the older child will become adultified, meaning that they're treated like another adult. They're shared very inappropriate information. The alienating parent will share with them court documents. They'll share with them events from the relationship with their ex that they shouldn't know about. And the child feels very empowered by this. The child feels very like, wow, I'm important because I know this, right? And I'm being treated as an equal. You'll see this parent be like a best friend to that child. And that's not a very healthy relationship at all for this child because, you need to have parent-child boundaries. It provides a lot of certainty for the child, particularly in adolescence when they really need it. And so on the surface, when you see these children, it looks like, you could look at them and go, wow, they're doing great. They're not alienated. But when you actually look at how they're reacting towards a parent and the trivial reasons that they give for why they don't want to go spend the weekend with them, that's your sure sign that alienation is happening, and the child is just learning to mask it very well. And they can come across very convincingly if you interview them. I've seen this in court cases where the child is severely alienated, but they'll go and talk to a judge, and the judge will be like, wow, well, they seem like they're doing fine. They seem like they're very independent and they have a mind of their own. But little did they know how much coaching has happened behind the scenes. They haven't seen, there's no reason why this child should reject this parent because the parent has never been abusive to them, right? Now, I haven't even, touched on the fact there are sometimes cases where you have a parent who's done something wrong and then the other parent will monopolize that and alienate them. This is something that sometimes referred to as hybrid cases. But I could tell you my research and a lot of other people who do work in this area do not find a lot of support that that's very common. There's been like one or two papers where people have said that these hybrid cases are common, and I frankly have not seen it. And the reason is because there's a power problem in these relationships. When you have a parent who has all control of that child, and which you see in parental alienation, that's what we call asymmetric dependence, where one parent has all power and control over the outcomes, and the other parent essentially is powerless, right? What happens to that parent who's powerless? Their behavioral options are very limited. Like, they can't do anything.
Would an example of that be, let's say, dad just has part-time visitation, mom has primary custody, dad is stressed out, the children are running wild, and maybe he swats one of the kids on the butt, but normally not abusive to the children, and the other parent finds out about this and uses this as a way to basically completely shut him out of the kid's life.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So in other words, it's dad is not perfect, and dad is not treating the children as well as he should. And there's times when he loses his cool, or maybe he didn't do the homework with the kids that week. So there are ways that dad can improve his performance all the way around, but the other parent is using this as a way to. Is this what you're referring to as a hybrid case that, but the parent who's on the outs really doesn't have the power?
But it's not really a hybrid case because, I mean, think about it. No parent, like you said, no parent is perfect. That's within the normal realm. I mean, parents get frustrated. Parents get upset. It doesn't mean, in effect, a parent might engage in what would on the surface be kind of considered an alienating behavior. But what's important to understand is that just because somebody does a behavior doesn't mean it's an alienating behavior. It's just a bad behavior. What makes it an alienating behavior is if it's a cluster of behaviors or patterns of behaviors done over time with the intent to hurt the other parent and the relationship with the child. If you see that, then that's what I would call an alienating behavior. Otherwise, it's just a parent doing something that, out of frustration and self-defense or anger. That isn't really what we would call an alienating behavior because it's not done with intent. It's done out of self-defense or just, being upset that they're in the corner, you know, like they have no control over the situation. But yes, the alienating parent then will take advantage of that because they have all the power and no power is enough for them. They're always going to try to get more, just like in any other kind of abusive relationship. And they will take advantage and exploit. And so that's where I think is really important, because you can, on the surface, if somebody doesn't know the dynamics of parental alienation, they will look at that and say, well, both parents are behaving badly. And that's not what's happening. I mean, it's true. People do things out of frustration, particularly parents who are alienated. I mean, it's a very painful thing to have your children swear at you and tell you they hate you when all you've tried to do is make them pancakes in the morning. I mean, that's a true story. I mean, parents who take their kids to Disney World, the kids come and say, I don't want to go to Disney World. It's too hot there. There's too many people. Now, who doesn't want to go to Disney World, right? The only reason they don't want to go to Disney World is because they've been influenced to not like their time with that parent.
Right.
So you have a parent and you're dealing with this. Of course, you're going to be frustrated. But it doesn't mean then that you're doing anything wrong, right? I mean, there's ways. I mean, the best thing an alienated parent can do, or a rejected parent can do, is get support and help and learn how to not respond, which is so hard to do because it's not easy to get all the time. And I know that for a fact personally as well. I mean, it's not an easy thing. And so you have to learn how to manage that in the face of this, because otherwise your children, or the children, will actually look at that and say, see, I was right. That parent was right. You're horrible, right? And they're looking for any reason to push that parent away. And so you can be the best parent in the world. I talked to a parent recently, like they didn't like that they got up and made them pancakes. And that was what they were upset with them about. I mean, you know, it's the most trivial thing sometimes. But let's say that parent does something wrong that isn't fantastic, but isn't horrible either. I mean, but or maybe it is bad, but it's nothing that a normal kid would hate you for the rest of their life. They might be angry with you. I mean, who wasn't angry with their parents when they were a kid over something because they grounded them for something
Yeah,
that they did? Of
of course.
course, it can be bad. But in an alienation situation, the targeted parent is powerless, because if they try to discipline their child like a normal parent would, it's used against them. And it makes them completely powerless, and they often feel hopeless, because there's really nothing they can do. They've lost all control, and their parental kind of power has been taken away, and the child is put in a position of power that's higher than them.
In my experience, having worked with domestic violence cases since 1992, many of which involve parents in a disputed custody case, the courts look at domestic violence as a more serious thing. They're more likely to take allegations of domestic violence seriously versus allegations of alienation. Often, I get skeptical looks from evaluators and attorneys when it comes to. More so with evaluators, when I bring up the possibility of alienation, it's more like, somebody's saying that to muck things up. Whereas accusations of domestic violence, even when they really aren't founded, are treated more seriously.
Yeah, I think, in general, I don't think that we're really well equipped to deal with domestic violence or child abuse overall. I mean, I think it's really hard, especially emotional abuse. Psychological abuse is really tough. And I know Child Protection Services, they have a really hard time dealing with that. I mean, physical abuse is a lot easier for them. It's identifiable, it's discreet, they can see what's happening. And it's harder to prove the other kinds of things. Particularly with alienation. I mean, parental alienation is something that happens over time. And I mean, sometimes there's some things a parent can do that have an impact, that are, you know, one-time event where they can make an allegation of abuse, and then it can take 6 to 9 months to investigate it. And in the meantime, the parent has no contact with that child, and then alienation can be very quick, right? Because the child has no contact, they're told all sorts of things, and then they don't know the other side of the story, and they you know, so in that case, it's a pretty easily identifiable situation when that might happen. But other times, alienation can take several years to really seep in, and especially when it's much more subtle, things that occur. And I mean, most children who are alienated don't, obviously, they don't recognize when it's happening. They're not aware of the kinds of things that parents are aware of that are happening behind the scenes. And so, it really. You know, so when I think courts then don't understand what it is, and if it's if it's something you have to document for a long period of time, I mean, what is there to do? I mean, I think it requires a child protection response because it is child abuse. The issue is, at what point is it considered child abuse? You know, we know with child abuse, there has to kind of reach a certain level in which it's severe enough, particularly with psychological abuse, for them to actually take action, or anybody to take action. And where is that? That's a moving target in general in the literature, right? There's not a lot of agreement about that, which you probably know that even better than I do. And so we still don't really know then where is it for alienation, right? We need more research on this to look at the longitudinal effects on children over time. We need to kind of learn whether there's certain patterns of behaviors that have differential impacts on children and what that looks like. And that's going to take devoted grant money and other things that we don't have yet, and hopefully we will at some point. I hope I'd really try to convey that whenever I go to court or work with mental health providers, to really show the seriousness of this, because we know that psychological abuse for children is worse than physical abuse. I mean, there's lots of publications on that. And this is psychological abuse as well. In fact, Vittorio Vizzetti has presented on this, and he published a paper a few years ago. He's a doctor or a psychiatrist in Italy. He presented some work recently when I was at a conference in Athens, where he shows that, the loss of a parent, through death, is very traumatic for a child. But actually, losing a parent through custody is worse. Like, so his work shows that when you lose a parent that way, it's worse, because with the loss of a parent through death, you usually still have a healthy functioning parent who you're still with, right? You lose one and then you still have a healthy functioning parent. But with alienation, you have a parent who is the healthy one that's being rejected, and you have the abusive parent then with that child. And so it's worse then for that child, because now they've lost one parent, and the other one that they're with is abusive.
And you mentioned Amy Baker earlier. In her in one of her books, she interviewed some adults who had been alienated as children, and there were long-term consequences. And often these individuals didn't realize they were being alienated until they became adults, and then they found some of the same dynamics with their own children. Can you talk about that, the long-term effects of parental alienation on children as they become parents themselves, and what are the consequences there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most people don't recognize it. I mean, I know people have done trainings, and people come up to them and go, "Oh my God, I'm sitting in the audience and I just realized that's what I lived through." They didn't realize it until they saw it presented to them. And I think what was most striking is, I recently saw that documentary, Finding Neverland. I don't know if you've seen that yet, about
Oh yeah, very
Michael Jackson.
powerful.
Yeah, and that really, when I was watching that, it just struck me how similar it was to parental alienation. You take away, obviously, the sexual abuse, but the same dynamics happen with alienating parents. The grooming that you see happening with children, you see that with parents who are alienating their children, forming allegiances, isolating them from their parents. And the way that the children in that documentary, the adult children, they didn't even really realize until they had their own children that they were abused. Right. And we see that with alienated children as well. When they have their own children, they often probably relive their dynamic, because they usually marry somebody or get into a relationship with somebody who is similar to the alienation dynamics that they saw modeled by their parents. And so then now they're in a situation where they are the victims. And unfortunately, then they have to now come to terms with their own feelings of loss from, their past, and now they're reliving it in this dynamic with their children. And it's very, very heartbreaking when parents come to that realization. And it's like a double whammy. I almost think that they have a harder time than even, I mean, it's hard enough to be somebody who has not had that from your own childhood and then have experienced that. But imagine then if you've had to come to the realization that happened to you is and it's happening again, and it's just it's very hard for parents.
Well, so based on what you've been telling us, it sounds like you're seeing parental alienation as a form of, in a way, a form of child abuse, psychological child abuse, because it affects the child directly. child suffers as a result, sometimes into adulthood. But also, what drives these parents, at least you're indicating on some level, is an attempt to control the other parent or even the score. So it would seem to me that an implication of all this is that parental alienation is also a form of domestic violence. I mean, it's a way that parents have of getting back, I guess, at the other parent. Can you speak to that?
Yes, absolutely. In the paper that we published in December, that's sort of the premise is because the intent, I guess I'm kind of an optimist where I don't like to think that these parents are deliberately trying to hurt their children. I mean, and so that's what made me think in my work, well, what are they really trying to do? What is the intent of this behavior? They're not acting randomly with aggression. They're acting with a purpose. They're acting to try to hurt the targeted parent, the other parent, sometimes out of retaliation and retribution for perceived wrongs that they had in their relationship. Sometimes it's out of jealousy and anger, frustration. Sometimes it's just purely out of just wanting to erase them entirely, right? They just want to get rid of them and move on. And so in that way, in my own work, I started just saying, well, geez, this isn't like just two people who don't get along and they just get into fights every now and then because they don't like something that they're doing. This is a much more deliberate strategy to hurt somebody, right? And in that way, it's very much like intimate terrorism, because that's what you see with the same dynamics with batterers, right? And this is why the chapter I described earlier that I just wrote with Mandy Mathewson, we use the power and control wheel because it's the all the dynamic the spokes on the wheel are exactly the kinds of behaviors that terrorists intimate terrorists use the or batterers use, and this is what alienators use as well. We can map on what they do exactly onto that wheel, and the motive is control and power over the other person and their child. Of course, children are of course are their weapons in doing this, and they're also their victims. And so that's really at the crux of it, because I really believe that the only way we can really stop this is if we also recognize parental alienation as another kind of domestic violence. Because if we can stop the behavior of that parent, you can't just stop it based on how they're acting towards their child. I mean, their intent is the other parent. That's their target. We need to understand why they're doing it. Why are they getting at this? We know that people who alienate their children are more likely to have personality disorders. They often have narcissism, psychopathy. In my work, we find there are very Machiavellianism, which is
Yeah,
kind of,
sort of the moral triad of personality traits. Yeah.
And now we're also finding sadism. In fact, in my work, the national poll I just ran, sadism is actually one of the best predictors of why somebody would do these behaviors. And that makes sense because they're doing it usually out of maliciousness and retribution, trying to make that person pay for what they think happened to them. We also see with this violence, patterns of behavior. So you see cycles. You see, for example, increases in parental alienating behaviors happen over in predictable times. So leading right up to custody hearings, you'll see allegations of abuse increase. If the other parent remarries or has children, you see increases in loyalty-inducing behaviors. So you see lots of different kinds of behaviors picking up around times that are predictable. And that's the same thing with intimate terrorism, right? You see cycles of violence. You
Right.
see tension building. I talked to a custody evaluator recently. He goes, yeah, except with this, you don't have the honeymoon phase. You don't get the flowers. You just get this constant, you either have violence or you don't, right? You have this aggression or you don't. And alienated parents are always feeling like they're waiting for the other shoe to drop. They're always waiting for the next call from CPS or the police. They're always waiting for the kids to show up and say they never want to see you again, because that's what it's like. And it's very much like somebody who's a victim of battery. And so now we also see perpetrators also often have had that happen to them in the past, right? Or they've been abused in the past, or they have a very bad childhood. And we see that with perpetrators of battery as well, right? So there's a lot of parallels. So that's kind of what my work is showing right now is my research. I'm trying to really uncover these power dynamics in these families and really showing the parallels between in alienators and batterers, because they're very similar in a lot of different ways.
And the two are that I'm glad that I'm glad that you're talking about this, that the way you're framing parental alienation, not as some strange theory that Richard Gardner came up with that allows, violent dads to get away with murder, but it's an actual real thing. And that a parental alienation, a parent may alienate the children but not be violent towards the other partner. At the same time, I've had cases where someone in my program, a male or a female, who has been arrested for domestic violence, is also alienating. So you could be an alienator and violent domestically, or just an alienator and engaging in what is really, as you say, a form of terrorism. And this really changes the game, I think. If more and more mediators, evaluators, judges, and so forth were aware of this research, I think they would have a much better idea of how to handle these families, because typically the domestic violence allegations tend to resonate more. So I've rarely seen cases where parents who have been found to alienate their children are court ordered to any kind of counseling for that. But it's very common for someone to be mandated to a batterer intervention program based upon domestic violence allegations. So
Absolutely.
yeah,
Yeah,
right.
absolutely.
One more question, Jennifer, before we wrap up today. Just because a child doesn't like a parent or is uncomfortable with a parent doesn't mean they've been alienated, right? So it's possible that they've actually been abused by that parent. Talk about the difference between parental alienation and just estrangement between the child and the parent. And also, I guess part B of the question would be, are you familiar with the work of Leslie Droz? And she came up years ago with a decision tree to help clinicians differentiate between the two.
So when we talk about estranged children, this is where children who have been abused or there's been a real problem with the parent-child relationship directly. But what we see with them, and this is why I say the symptoms for alienated children are different than in those situations, is you don't see the same kind of splitting or you see very little ambivalence in alienated children. Children who are abused, ambivalent. Right, they love their abuser. You know, we can go back to the Finding Neverland movie with, they love Michael Jackson, but yet he was abusive and they defended him even though it hurt that he rejected them and loved some other boys, right? I mean, there's this, this love of this parent and yet you will protect them. I mean, we see this with, Amy Baker in her kind of presentation, she outlines how we see this with foster care children. Foster care children come from a very abusive homes, and when they age out of the system, they go right back to those families. They love them, and yet they were still abusive. And sometimes then, obviously there's distance, right? And people will say like, "Oh, I don't really want to be around them that much." As they get older, they start to do that, and they form healthy boundaries. But when a child's estranged, they don't look at all. They don't present the same way as an alienated child. Alienated children will, find excuses like why they don't want to see them, and they'll say, "Oh, I don't want to see them because they don't love me, they don't want to see me, or they weren't there for me." And while it may appear that that was the case because they worked all the time and all this stuff, and that will be portrayed to many evaluators as the case, but you have to dig deeper than that because most children who are actually estranged will not talk that way. And they call that justified estrangement, and that just drives me crazy because I. Usually a children will protect people who are abusive. They will protect them, and that's why they protect the alienator so vehemently. They will automatically and reflexively protect them. And even though they are sadly abusing them by hurting the relationship with the other parent. And so usually when I see a child who's doing that and is refusing to see them, unless there's ac even if there's I mean if there's actual abuse and the child's rejecting them so vehemently, my first, I would say there's probably both going on here, because children usually won't reject them still, even if no matter how abusive they are. You'll see ambivalence, you'll see a lot of pain, you'll see them saying, "Oh, but they will feel guilty about it, they'll feel sad about it, because they feel a lot of times children feel responsible for the abuse that they undergo, right? They blame themselves. They blame other things besides the actual parent. They'll make excuses for that parent. But so anyway, so that I hope that answers your question, but that's why, you could usually tell if a child is rejecting them flat out and there's abuse that's actually been happening. I would probably assume then that in that case, abuse happened and the alienating parent took advantage of that and really made it worse for that child.
Well, I really, really enjoyed this interview. You've been extremely informative. The area of child custody and allegations of domestic violence and parental alienation is so fraught with controversy and lack of transparency in the way people, frame these debates. And you really illuminated this very well for us today. I really want to thank you again for taking time out of your busy schedule. If someone wanted to contact you, they could contact you at University of Colorado.
I'm at Colorado State University. Yeah, I know we always get mixed up with the two. Yeah, so I'm up at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. Yeah, I have also a website, a personal website, jenniferjillharmon.com. That's my just for my other, I post various things on there as well. So,
Harman.
yes, correct.
Okay. Thank you again.
Okay, yeah, thank you.